having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Sure wasn't supposed to. Okay. Well, good evening, everybody. Good to see you. And yeah, let's try that little forms change and see how that feels for a while. So just to do the robe chant together, whether you wear a keser or ruksu, you know, doesn't matter. Just do the robe chant together right before the first zazen, whether we're meeting in the morning or the evening. Because most of us haven't had the robe on before that day. It's kind of a carryover from a monastic, you know, 24-hour routine. Just be consistent, and then we'll all learn the chants, that robe chant together better. And we'll see if that goes on past COVID, probably, I don't know. Something else I was going to announce. Apparently not everyone saw the updated announcement amongst your gazillion emails, but we had to move the closing ceremony and procession away with our altar forward in time. So it'll be Saturday next, Saturday, September 19th at 5 o'clock at the Dharma Hall. And only a very few people will get to be in the Zendo. So, you know, I'll let the few people know who they are. But we'll work it out that all the rest of us out on the sidewalk will have a ritual thing that we can do. We'll get to formally offer incense and say goodbye to the building, whether you're inside or just outside. And also to invite you, you know, member thing is you can go to the Dharma Hall and use it individually. At the moment, it's kind of a dirty shell, but to invite you to go to Dharma Hall and just stand and breathe and say goodbye and could chant a little bit, or there's no cushions there anymore or chairs. But you could sit on the floor, do a little zazen. It'd be good, you know. We put a lot into the place. And that's available the whole month of September. And then we lose our occupancy. So saying goodbye, change. And what a wonderful process we did together to make that decision. And it was so interesting to watch each of us kind of one by one have to go through a little arc of, what? And then I'm grateful we all came to agreement and consensus that it's just the thing to do next. And then eventually to have a new building. Maybe we'll own it, whatever ownership really means. Because, yeah, it's kind of like problematic for us to go around talking to our donors about a permanent home, right? What would that mean? So I thought for tonight's talk, I'd actually read you a story that showed up in the New York Times. So you may or may not have seen it. It's not a news story. It's a story from their column called Modern Love. So it's a love story. And the reason why I want to read you this is because I was thinking about how so many of the koan stories and the sutra stories and so many Buddha stories, yeah, especially like the Jataka stories, the tales before the Buddha was Buddha, they're full of really far out stuff, you know, and things that we reference regularly, like the three realms of existence and the six, you know, levels of being and all this stuff are actually, you know, pretty far out for us, you know. And, you know, and maybe we see all that stuff as kind of cute or myth or like cultural kind of additions to the Buddha's pure understanding or something like that. But and some of them we can kind of remap in a very useful everyday way as like psychology, like the six realms. That's the word I wanted a minute ago. The six realms, you know, you can be born to the hells or the hungry ghost realm or the animal realm or the human realm or the deva realm or the god realm, right? So, you know, those are useful to think about as a moment-by-moment kind of psycho-spiritual experience that we and our circumstances manage to put ourselves into hell regularly, right? And a lot of us are often hanging out in the hungry ghost world, right? Always wanting more, you know. Capitalism depends on us being hungry ghosts. And animals are sort of simple and, you know, run on instinct. And how often do we do that, right? Like the animal realm was like habit energy, you know, just running on instinct, not thinking about what you're doing. The early Buddhists didn't have the same kind of green Sierra Club idea of animals that we do. And we know what the human realm is like, but from that frame, we can appreciate the human realm a little more, right? That what's great about the human realm is that we suffer, but we don't get so overwhelmed by suffering that we can't practice, and the suffering encourages us to practice, right? Would you do this if you didn't have to? I hope not. And then we can bliss ourselves out and kind of edge into the higher realms above the human realm, but then we find out those are unsatisfying, you know? Those aren't great. And there's good psychological research that accords to this, that people who don't have enough stress are not so happy either, you know? Life is too easy. Lacking of challenge or something, you know? So anyway, we can think about a lot of these traditional teachings and the magical happenings as, you know, sort of psychology or metaphor or myth. You know, like the last koan or a couple of koans ago, we were studying the way Manjushri shows up and snaps his fingers and sends this super meditating woman to the heaven realm so he can walk around her and try to get her out of her samadhi, right? You know, it's really far out, you know. But I think, you know, it might be that if we do too much of that sort of like making those stories tidy in our minds, oh, that's a cute myth, you know. We may miss some of their meaning, you know, we may miss some of their truth, you know. And the Buddhists of the day probably, very likely, believed in those things very literally. I remember Norman used to give talks about Dogen saying, you know, Dogen didn't think this was just far out stuff, you know. He was in the middle of it, you know, deeply true, you know, deeply true. So I think we'll get more out of these teachings if we can also inhabit that level of it, you know, the kind of literal truth of it, that yes, when I die, I really could be reborn, you know, in some other realm. And so I really, one more reason to keep upright and practice well and be ethical, you know, so I can have the good fortune to be born again as a human so I can continue my bodhisattva work, you know. And that maybe there are Buddhas appearing in flowers, you know? Have you really looked, you know? Maybe all these things really do happen. And one way to kind of, I think, prevent that sort of modern ism that we do, which is an ism, you know? We think, well, I'm not a this ist or that ist, but you're definitely a modernist, you know? And there's a certain way that modernists flatten things out, you know, make things tidy, ignore the non-rational because only the rational could possibly be true. And, well, two ways, actually, two ways we can kind of counterbalance that. Like, not oppose it, but counterweight, counterbalance it. One is to actually pay attention to the really weird things that do happen in your life, right? Many of us have had experiences we cannot explain, you know. And collectively, we had some experiences, some of us at the Samish Island Sesshin some years ago, where spirits were visiting and strange feelings were had and wasn't really explainable, you know. Maybe it's literally that, you know, spirits, we don't know. And the other thing is to really listen to other stories of other people in the modern age where strange stuff happens, you know, that we can't exactly explain with science. And Buddhism itself has carried that forward. Like one example would be the Tibetan system of reborn lamas, the way the Tibetans can go off and find through omens and signs a child who might well be the reborn being, the reborn lama, and then they test the child. You know, they don't just take it on faith exactly, right? So they're like scientific in a certain way. The visiting high lamas test the child and put out different ritual objects. And if the child is really the reborn lama, they'll recognize their former stuff. And they do, you know? You know, I mean, we could send in the occultists and the magicians and say, oh, well, that's because the child was subtly signaled by, you know, maybe unconsciously by the lamas, you know. They changed their expression slightly when the child's hand moved closer to the correct mala or the correct dorje. But I don't know. That seems a little too simple. So this story reminded me of that too. The things that happen, even in the modern age, are not only rational and not only metaphor and not only cute psychology, but also kind of magical, right? So here's a love story with a little magic in it, after all that introduction. It's called A glance and a rooster that changed everything. And it's written by a woman named Naomi Brynvillis. So this is a woman's voice narrating. Naomi Brynvillis, and she's in Haiti. A wooden spoon, a green onion, a pot with three legs, one bottle of Florida water, another of Champagne André, three candles, a bag of Poudre Pajanbe, don't cross here powder, and most important, a young rooster. I'm going to read that opening paragraph again because it doesn't hang together in your mind, right? A wooden spoon, a green onion, a pot with three legs, one bottle of Florida water, another of Champagne André, three candles, a bag of Poudre Pajanbe, don't cross here powder, and most important, a young rooster. And I had been warned not to haggle over the rooster. The merchant had five birds. One was old and orange, three were adolescents, good for fighting, but not much else. The last was energetic, almost enthusiastic. His red feathers looked gold in the sunlight. How much for him? I asked. She picked him up. 300 gourdes, she said, a little over $7. I paid her, tucked the bird under my arm, and walked home. It was April 2010. 4 months earlier, an earthquake had killed hundreds of thousands of my fellow Haitians. My family and I were homeless, sleeping behind a Mormon church, and I needed something to change. Born in a town on Haiti's west coast, I had lived with my father and mother and seven siblings in Tigini, the fisherman's quarter, until our house was washed away in a flood. We slept on the floor of an aunt's house and then in a Baptist church. My father was a good man who could never get ahead. He left our family when I was 17. My mother sold patties at a local school. We survived on her daily wages, which I now know were less than $1 a day. Finding money for school was an ordeal. My sisters and I always wanted what we couldn't have: dolls, shoes, a backpack, a cell phone. As the oldest sibling, I felt responsible for the others. I moved to Port-au-Prince for college, which I attended when I could get the money to pay for it, and I was there when the earthquake struck, on a bus on my way to class. I later learned that the school building collapsed, killing many of my classmates. It then took me 12 hours to journey by foot through the ruined downtown to my uncle's house in Aviation, a neighborhood near the old airport. My aunt was among the first to make camp on this old runway, where she was soon joined by thousands. With the cell phone towers destroyed, I couldn't reach my family. For 5 days, my mother thought I was dead. It took me that long to travel the 67 kilometers, almost 42 miles, to Petit Goave. The highway bridges were out, so we had to exit the buses each time and wade to the other side. I returned home to find my family sleeping in the street. The next months were a nightmare. I slept when I could, because I was hungry all the time. Finally, in the depths of despair, I accompanied my friend to visit his spiritual guide, a vaudou priest in the town of Léogné. As soon as he saw me, the priest knew what was wrong. There's a shadow over your life. What do you mean? You must be first in a room, but you're last to be seen. And so he wrote me a prescription: a green onion, a wooden spoon, and a young rooster, and told me to return with these items, to return when I'd gathered these important items. When I asked my mother for the money, she said, I taught you the way of light. This is the way of darkness. As a devout Christian, she disapproves of vaudou. I told her this was a deeper darkness than any I had ever faced, and that I was desperate for change, and she finally gave me some money. I filled the prescription, and left for the priest's house with my sister. The rooster was killed, and I was painted in his blood. Afterward, I bathed in water infused with citrus leaves and Florida water. When I offered my sister a piece of the cooked rooster, the priest said, "No, you eat your fill before anyone else." This accomplished, I was to go home and place a glass of water under the moon, and then I must awake before anyone else, take the water in my mouth, and spit in the cardinal directions. The priest said I would be washed. I would then be washed and bright as a new penny. He was right. A month later, when the whites arrived, aid workers, mostly from Europe, I was hired by Oxfam International to work as a hygiene specialist in the tent camps. I made more money in 1 month doing this work than my mother had made in a year. In October, when the cholera epidemic started, I was transferred to the public health campaign and went into the camps with iodine tabs and bars of soap, teaching prevention and hygiene. The hygienists were invited to tour the new cholera treatment center when it opened. We found a series of tents set up over white gravel. The incoming patients were stripped naked and sprayed with a blast of chlorine mist. What I remember most about that day is not the smell of the place or even the morgue they were building. It was the man I saw exiting the tent carrying a 5-gallon bucket. He was handsome and enthusiastic, blonde into the sunlight. I had not expected my rooster to be white. We made contact, that was all. We made eye contact, that was all. When I got home, I told my sister I had seen my rooster, and I was afraid I would never see him again. But we did see each other again, at a concert. His name was Xander. When he asked in Creole for my phone number, I gave it to him. And I woke the next day to find he had texted to say good morning. "Are you married?" I wrote. "No." "You have kids?" "No." My grandmother lived in the mountains. Every few weeks, she would come see my family in the city, bringing cocoa and coffee that she grew herself. Everyone called her Madame Tiklis, Madame Tiklis, or Mrs. Smallseed, because she was only 4'10". When she came to see us over Christmas, she was amazed to hear that I had gotten a job. "The job's not all she got," my mother said, mentioning my white boyfriend. My grandmother said she had never associated with a white person outside of church, and she didn't think they were all that friendly or good to be around. But she returned a few weeks later with her own boyfriend, Emwa. They'd been dating for 20 years. And she said she wanted to hear the story. And afterwards, she insisted I bring Xander to their house for a visit. Emma was worried about the bad road and the long hike and the sorry state of the house, which had become infested with termites. "He truly cares for her," my grandmother said. "He will come." This invitation was a test. When I was worried that Xander would fail, not wanting to trek into the mountains to visit my poor grandmother, but he said he would come. On Sunday, we left town in a little tap-tap, little truck, and made our way to my grandmother's house, a little truck taxi. I was ashamed of the dirt floor, but Xander didn't seem to notice. Our relationship deepened as the strife around us grew worse. Cholera ravaged the tent camps. Hundreds got sick. Soon the morgue was filled. Xander and I would meet for lunch, scrubbing our hands with Clorox soap, and then he would put his head in my lap, and I would play with his hair. He extended his stay once and again until his visa was about to expire. The first thing Xander did when he landed in Miami, before he called his own family, was to call me. And after that, we spoke for hours every day. Neighbors told me he would never return, that I was just a way to pass the time. But on the phone, he asked if I wanted to come live with him. I didn't know if he was serious. I had never left Haiti or flown on a plane. "Why would he bring you to America?" my friend said. But he did return, with a ring. He got on one knee and asked me to marry him. That was 10 years ago. In American movies, couples always seem to have so much in common. Xander and I couldn't even speak the same language. He was still learning Creole when we met, and although I now speak English fluently, I sure didn't then. But we know something that American cinema doesn't know. Love has its own language. I was born in the tropics, a black girl in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. My husband was born in the North, a white man from the richest country on Earth. From the day we first saw each other at the cholera treatment center, all that fell away, and we were naked to each other as Naomi and Xander. Ever since, for thousands of nights, we have said, "I love you," to each other in the dark. And then we have fallen asleep, marveling that it took an earthquake, an epidemic, a rooster, and a passing glance to bring us together. That's the story. So, didn't seem that far away from Buddha's appearing in the heavens to me. So, well, this is really worth thinking about. I think we're always going to encounter everything we encounter with a habitual framework, right? Our habitual way of looking at things. And so I think it's worthwhile really kind of being deliberate and curious when we encounter something that's a little outside of our Western scientific rational reality, whether it's a story from Haiti or an old Buddhist teaching. You know, what's like a really, I don't know, open, helpful, and interesting way to engage with this story, you know? And in a way, everything's stories, right? We think it's all kind of real or something, but it's all stories, right? Stories we remember, stories we tell, stories others tell us. So how do we hold it all, you know, as bodhisattvas? Thanks for listening to that. And maybe I'll just stop the recording and just open the floor. Have any thoughts about all this?